Welcome to Innovation Hub. I'm Kara Miller. We hear all the time about our changing climate. It's getting hotter. Records keep getting set. And we keep releasing waste from our cars, our food, our power plants. But research shows there may be some ingenious ways to actually press rewind on the story of the climate and cool things down. Either by grabbing back some of the carbon dioxide from the atmosphere or by reflecting sunlight into space before it ever hits the Earth. Cooling us off, though, just like heating us up, comes with some real risks. Joining me are Brad Allenby, a professor at Arizona State University, and Ken Caldera, a climate scientist at the Carnegie Institute for Science. Brad and Ken, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Kara.
Brad, before we get into techniques that we might use to change the climate, let's look back a little. How long has it been that people have either tried to change the weather, change whether it's raining today or not, or tried to mess with the climate, just sort of, you know, how hot is the earth this year?
People have been looking at weather modification for a long time, back in the 1950s, as part of the Cold War confrontation, both the Soviet Union and the United States were doing research in weather modification. Climate modification has had to wait until we had tools, computational tools and models, that allowed us to understand the climate well enough to even think of modifying it. So it's a much more recent innovation.
And Ken, if there was going to be some kind of climate engineering, what ways are there of changing the climate?
First, it's important to distinguish between two big approaches to interfering in the climate system. And one idea is to remove greenhouse gases from the atmosphere. So this would be removing the carbon dioxide that we've emitted into the atmosphere. And this, some variations of it are controversial, but the basic idea is not that controversial because trees do this already. The more controversial idea is the idea of reflecting additional sunlight to space. And this has happened after big volcanoes put little particles in the stratosphere that scattered sunlight back to space. And so one idea is that humans could do much as volcanoes do and put a bunch of tiny particles in the stratosphere and reflect sunlight to space, thereby cause the Earth to cool.
Right. And as you say, volcanoes can really change the temperature. I remember when the volcano in Iceland erupted, and at least in a certain part of the world, things got darker and sunlight just, you know, did not filter down to the Earth in the way that it used to.
Yeah, there are three big volcanoes that occurred since 1960 that caused the Earth to cool substantially, with the biggest being Mount Pinatubo in 1991. And in 1992, the planet was more or less a degree Fahrenheit cooler than it otherwise would have been, despite the increasing rise in greenhouse gases.
Now, do we have the science to reflect sunlight back into space? And are those techniques safe?
I think there's a big difference between being able to do it and being able to do it in a wise kind of way, and if that's possible. And it's thought that the overall technology for putting little particles in the stratosphere is fairly straightforward. There are planes that can go up to the stratosphere now. There's spraying technologies are well developed. The bigger question is, what are the unintended consequences of doing such a dramatic act?
Brad, I want to get into the idea of sort of sucking carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. We put it in, maybe we should take it out. But I just wonder, when scientists get together, when they talk about these kinds of solutions, which seem very big and very radical, do people think, well, this is really something we may have to do? Or is there a lot of hesitation about fiddling with nature this way?
Well, I think there's both. The idea that you would do this if you didn't have to, is probably not one that's widely held at all. The question is, when do the costs and benefits of trying something that, as Ken says, is not well understood and whose implications aren't well understood, when do those potential costs become outweighed by the benefits of preventing further global warming? It's important to remember that any technology that is powerful enough to change the climate is powerful enough to have a lot of unanticipated consequences, which will include things like changing the geopolitical power structures. So it's important to be able to respond not just to the challenges that climate change may be presenting, but to the challenges that we create in responding to climate change.
So draw that out for me. How does either sending sunlight back into the sky or sucking carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, how does that have a geopolitical impact?
Well, for example, if the climate warms, it is at least plausible that you would begin to see countries like Canada and Russia able to exploit more of their resources, because right now those resources are under ice and very cold areas and hard to get to. If the climate were to warm up, it's possible that they would be able to access those resources, and that would change their ability to participate in the economy and potentially their geopolitical status. So there are a lot of implications that come into play. Now, this gets worse if you deploy technologies where the unanticipated consequences could be, for example, shifting the monsoon patterns. If that happens, then you're looking at the potential for major chaos in countries like India, and that, of course, becomes a problem for the entire world.
Ken, this sounds like where science bumps up against ethics and issues of food supply and, as Brad said, politics. I mean, changing the climate is a question probably far beyond the mechanics of can you do it?
Yes. And I think just to expand on what Brad was saying about the carbon dioxide removal and the reflecting sunlight, the carbon dioxide removal is hard. And more or less for every molecule you throw in the atmosphere, you have to do something to pull that molecule back out. And so that's a long, hard, time-consuming effort. Whereas the solar geoengineering things, some of them involve, you know, it would involve, say, 1/1000th of the number of airplanes now flying for commercial aviation. And so it is the kind of thing that a relatively small country could in principle do on their own. And, you know, we see right now with this migration into Europe how this is potentially politically unsettling. And if vast areas of the tropics become very hot and it's difficult to grow food, there could be large-scale migration pressures, and there could be pressure to do something very quickly about climate change. And as we saw after Mount Pinatubo, the earth cooled the next year. And so if a politician wants to do something that would have an effect on climate within their term in office or within their political career, these solar geoengineering things are just about the only thing they can do. Energy system transitions and carbon dioxide removal will take many decades, but this reflecting sunlight would have a climate effect very quickly.
And could a politician affect the climate unilaterally? I mean, could the president of the United States or the president of Russia or something say unilaterally without getting a lot of people to agree to a treaty, you know, that this is what we're going to do? Could they say, no, we're doing this and it's happening in Russia, and then the effects would be whatever they are?
It would be within the technical capability of any large country. You know, and as we saw, say, with the invasion of Iraq, that if you get a collection of powerful countries together, they can act, you know, to a certain extent as they please in contravention of international law. But countries have to suffer the long-term political consequences of their actions. And so if a small group of countries does deploy a system and other countries feel threatened by it, there's a lot of scope for political or even military conflict.
Brad, let's get back for a second to techniques. Ken said that he thinks in some ways the sort of easiest thing to do would be reflecting sunlight back into space to help cool the planet down. Is it your view that that is also easier than, you know, sucking carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere?
It's easier. And for that reason, I think it's also a very dangerous choice. Because we tend to like easy things, particularly if they give us results in a short period. I think we need to frame this in a world that is increasingly becoming dominated by human activities, the Anthropocene, the world that humans are creating. And the reason for doing that is that it means that the simple solutions, and Ken is absolutely right, putting, say, sulfur dioxide particles in the atmosphere would be a simple solution. Those can be very dangerous precisely because we think of them as solutions, when in fact what we have is a long-term condition that results from 7 billion people on the planet that needs to be managed. And that implies a level of care and a level of concern that perhaps the discourse to date hasn't adequately reflected. There's also another thing about the solution that's inexpensive, the cheaper solution and the faster one. And that is that if you reflect sunlight back into space, you don't reduce the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere.
Right, right. People just go right on polluting, but hopefully the climate, you know, things cool down a little bit.
Well, they'll cool down, but because the atmosphere has more CO2 in it, more carbon dioxide, it's going to continue to acidify the oceans. And we're at a point now where people are becoming concerned about the effect of ocean acidity on mollusks and on other ocean life. So you solve the temperature problem, but you don't address the shift in chemical composition of the atmosphere. So all of these solutions have different costs and benefits, and that's one of the reasons we need to be sophisticated in how we think about it.
I'm actually interested in the answer to this from both of you. Do you worry that even talking about the idea that science may be able to mitigate global warming in some sort of either magic bullet way or even long-term way gets people to think, well, then, it doesn't really matter if we build another smokestack, or it doesn't really matter if we, you know, create some more stuff that we don't need because science is going to fix this?
I think we're at a bit of a crossroads where we need to decide as a civilization whether this is going to be mostly a natural world and we're going to try to walk as lightly as possible on that world and interfere as little as possible in natural systems, or are we going to really take control of this planet and manage it the way we've managed so many other things? And I think this idea of solar geoengineering really brings this question to the fore. And I would hope that civilization makes an active decision to let nature dominate and for us to try to interfere as little as possible. But I think if we don't actively work towards that, we might someday find ourselves needing to or wanting to deploy these rather scary technologies.
And I'm guessing you don't see us doing the first option, the sort of treading lightly on the earth option.
I have hope. I don't know if I have an expectation, but I have hope.
Okay. And Brad, what's your view here?
Instead of my view, let me look at the world as it is. You have 7 billion people. They want a better life for themselves. They want a better life for their children. There are a huge number of human issues that are tied to these scientific-sounding natural systems. I think that the time for us to not develop a technologically-based civilization may have existed in the past. I think we've gone beyond that point. So I think while I like Ken's idea, I think that realistically speaking, we had better be prepared for a world that is increasingly dominated by humans and learn how to behave wisely and rationally under those conditions, not because the first choice wouldn't be perhaps one that we would all prefer, but because I very much doubt that's the way the system is going.
Well, then, okay, so then a final question for both of you, which is, you know, if we're not that good at planning ahead, as you both said, and we don't necessarily tread that lightly on the planet, should a whole bunch more money be going into thinking about climate engineering and how it would work and how it would be deployed so that when it is needed, maybe not tomorrow, maybe not next year, maybe not in 10 years, we know to the best of our ability what we're doing?
I would put in, say, 1% of the money that I would put in maybe for developing clean energy technologies, I would put into thinking about these technologies. It would be a minor component of a much broader portfolio, but I think it's an important component of that portfolio.
Yeah, I agree. I think one of the mistakes we make is thinking of technologies in silos, like fracking, for example. Nobody thinks of that as a climate management technology, but it may well be, in retrospect, a very important one. Another example is people are working on growing meat in factories, which could have a number of substantial positive benefits on climate if done properly. But none of these are conceptualized as part of a portfolio of technologies. I think Ken is absolutely right. We need to be much more sophisticated, particularly in the scientific and engineering communities, in developing portfolios of options so that when the politicians fail, we have options that are as safe and that we understand as much as possible. And I don't think we can say that's the case today.
Yeah, it's like my kid. I keep telling my kid that he doesn't want to do anything to close off options and that he should be trying to keep his options open. And, you know, I think that's a good advice for society as a whole.
When the politicians fail, the scientists step up. Ken Caldera is a climate scientist at the Carnegie Institution for Science, and Brad Allenby is a professor at Arizona State University. Thanks so much to both of you for this great conversation.
Thank you, Kara.
Go to our website, innovationhub.org, to learn about this week's guests and the work they do. You can also get more info on our Facebook page, facebook.com/innovationhubradio. From PRI and WGBH Radio, I'm Kara Miller, and this is Innovation Hub. You told me to just simply wonder rather than take shelter.